So as I said then, we're going to be continuing our studies in Ruth this evening. And our passage is the one that I read a few minutes ago, Ruth chapter 2, verse 18 to chapter 3, verse 5. Ruth chapter 2, verse 18 to chapter 3, verse 5. And I'd like us to look at this passage this evening then, under two headings. And first of all, an excited epiphany. An excited epiphany. Now I'm using that word epiphany in its loosest and most non-technical sense. The way in which then people might say, well, I was eating my breakfast the other day and I suddenly had an epiphany. Or I was on the train and I had an epiphany. And what they mean is then they had a moment of sudden realization. And Naomi here then, in the end of Ruth chapter 2, she has an epiphany. She has a moment of realization. She realizes that things are unfolding around her in such a way as raises an exciting possibility. She realizes that things are unfolding around her in such a way as raises an exciting possibility. Now there's a humorous dimension almost, isn't there, to Ruth's arrival home from the harvest field on this first evening of her gleaning. And you can almost imagine then Naomi sitting there at home in her living room, and hearing the door open and Ruth come into the house, and perhaps barely looking up from her Sudoku puzzle or whatever she was doing as she shouted to Ruth, hello dear, there's some tea in the pot, help yourself. But then being forced to look up and take notice as Ruth staggers into the living room carrying enough barley to feed almost a small army. And just then staring in disbelief at this. And then being taken to an even higher level of amazement, as Ruth, probably rather enjoying this reaction in her mother-in-law, like a conjurer, produces her next trick and pulls out some more produce. But this time, it's already cooked. It's some roasted grain that, of course, we know is the leftovers from her lunch that Boaz had provided for her. And so she pulls that out as well there in verse 18. And here's Naomi then, and she's in this kind of desperate attempt to just process all of this. What's happening here? And she, in verse 19, kind of blurts out these two questions, doesn't she? The second of which is totally unnecessary because it's just a repetition, really, of the first. And then, actually, she doesn't even give Ruth time to answer, does she, before she goes on to say something else. Blessed be the man who took notice of you. And you can sense then, just by the way she's acting, the way she's speaking here, she's utterly amazed by Ruth's arrival and the nature of it. But all of that actually is just the warmer part, isn't it? Because the best bit then of Ruth's arrival comes in verse 19, where Naomi's already overstretched brain has now to compute this next sensational part of Ruth's report. The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. Perhaps following that, you can almost imagine Naomi grabbing Ruth by the arm and leading her into the bedroom and opening a drawer and pulling out a photo album. I know they wouldn't have had photo albums, but I'm letting our imaginations run wild a little. And flicking through then the pages and finding a fading photo of her wedding day marrying Elimelech, and pointing feverishly to a man standing in the background of the picture, the very man that Ruth had met that day in the harvest field. Turning to another picture of Mahlon, just a few days old, and holding him lovingly is the very man Ruth had met that day in the fields. And it's as then all of this sinks in that Ruth has been to Boaz's field. Of all the fields, it's Boaz's field she stepped into. And that Boaz has been immediately so kind and so generous to Ruth. It's as all that sinks in to Naomi's brain that she has then this epiphany. She has this moment of realization. Now, this epiphany then, it's based on her knowledge of two concepts from the law of Moses. So let's just notice those. First of all, the concept of the kinsman redeemer. So notice she uses that word redeemer there at the end of verse 20. What's that all about? Well, when an Israelite family then got itself into some difficulty, a relative of the family was expected to perform the role of kinsman redeemer and come to the aid and help out then this family that has got into difficulty. So perhaps the family, out of economic necessity, had had to sell its land. Well, in that case, the relative, the kinsman redeemer, was to come to the family's aid and redeem the land, buy it back on behalf of the family. You can read about that in Leviticus 5, 25 to 30. Then again, perhaps some members of the family, again out of economic necessity, had been sold into slavery. Again, the kinsman redeemer, this close relative, was to come to the family's aid and redeem those family members who had been sold into slavery, buy them back. That's Leviticus 25, 47 to 55. Or then again, perhaps a member of the family had been murdered. And in this instance, the kinsman redeemer, the close relative, was to come to the family's aid by avenging the murder and finding the murderer and killing that person. And so those were some of the roles then that the kinsman redeemer was to perform. He was to come to the aid of the family when the family had gotten itself into difficulty. And so half of Naomi's epiphany then is at that level. Here is her family, and it's certainly in difficulty. Three men have died: Elimelech, Mahlon, Chilion, leaving just these two widows now, Naomi and Ruth. The family is unquestionably in difficulty. And here's Boaz, and he's a close relative. He can be the kinsman redeemer who comes to their aid. So that's part of her epiphany. But then the other concept she's basing all of this on is the concept of levirate marriage. The concept of levirate marriage. Now this word levirate, L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E, you won't find it anywhere in the Law of Moses. It's a Latin word. It comes from the Latin word lever, which means brother-in-law. And we use this word then to sum up some legislation that we find in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 to 10. And it's essentially this, that if a married man died childless, then an unmarried brother of his should marry the widow and have children on behalf of the deceased. That was essentially levirate marriage. An unmarried brother of the deceased man marrying his widow so that they could have children for the deceased man. And that then shapes the other half of Naomi's epiphany here. Here is Boaz. And as we've already said then, he's a close relative. He can be the kinsman redeemer who comes to the aid of Naomi's family, Elimelech's family. But more than that, he can do so specifically, Naomi now thinks, by marrying Ruth and having children on behalf of Mahlon, who of course has died. It's clear, I think, that right from the outset, marriage is on Naomi's mind here. She doesn't think of that later when we come to chapter 3. Right from the outset here, in this living room encounter that first evening, Naomi's already thinking in terms of marriage. You can tell that by the language she uses there in verse 20, where she says, "May he," that is Boaz, "be blessed by the Lord." And then in our ESV, we have, "whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Better, "who has not forsaken kindness." And she's talking about the Lord there. She's talking about Yahweh there. "Who has not forsaken kindness." Now that is a verbatim allusion to Genesis 24:27, where you have Abraham's servant saying exactly the same thing. "Blessed be the Lord who hasn't forsaken steadfast love," there in the ESV. It's the same word, chesed, kindness. "Who hasn't forsaken kindness to my master." And what's Abraham's servant talking about there in Genesis 24:27? Well, of course, he's just made that journey to find a wife for Isaac. And the kindness then to which he's referring is God's kindness in providing a spouse for Isaac. And surely then when Naomi here uses the exact same language, she's saying, wow, God hasn't forsaken kindness. He's showing his kindness still in providing a spouse for Ruth. And so, I hope you understand then what I'm saying, that here's Naomi. And on the basis of a combination of these two Old Testament concepts, these two Law of Moses concepts, she's had this moment of realization. Boaz can help us out here by marrying Ruth. And it is important, of course, that it's a combination of those two Old Testament concepts, because either of those two concepts in isolation is inapplicable here. So the concept of the kinsman redeemer, well, that doesn't quite apply here by itself, does it? Because nowhere in the Law of Moses was marriage a responsibility of the kinsman redeemer. But then equally, if you take the concept of the levirate marriage by itself, that doesn't apply, strictly speaking, here, because that was the duty of a brother-in-law, and Boaz isn't a brother-in-law in this case. So either of these concepts taken by itself doesn't apply, but Naomi here is kind of combining the two, and I think doing so legitimately, as one commentator puts it. Although the story of Boaz and Ruth does not follow the letter of the law, it certainly captures its spirit. So that then is Naomi's epiphany. And just before we move on to our second heading, I do just want to linger for a moment on her words there in verse 20. Her exclamation about Yahweh, who hasn't forsaken kindness. He hasn't forsaken his kindness. Of course, the background to that is all she had said earlier in chapter 1, verses 20 and 21. Remember her bitterness there. And the way she there conceived of Yahweh as being her adversary. "He's testifying against me," she'd said. There she was all accusation against him. She couldn't recognize any divine kindness at that point, in those circumstances. Three men dead. But now she's admitting that she's wrong, or that she'd been wrong, rather. And I think she's doing so actually in a more self-reproaching way than is immediately evident here. As I mentioned a moment ago, the word she uses here for kindness, it is that strong, powerful, pregnant Hebrew word chesed. Unfailing love is really the meaning of that word. And really then, to say that somebody hasn't forsaken their chesed is actually stating the obvious. It's what we call an axiom, a self-evident statement. Because if somebody had forsaken their hesed, it wouldn't have been hesed at all, because it's in the very nature of hesed that you can't forsake it. And I think she's putting it like this then to kind of berate herself, to kind of reproach herself. What was I doing thinking like that there at the end of chapter 1? What was I doing thinking of Yahweh as my unloving adversary? How could I have been so dumb? Of course his hesed was operative. Even that night that I sat by my husband's bedside and watched his life ebb away. Of course Yahweh's hesed was operative. Even that moment I got the phone call from a distraught Orpah telling me that Kilion had died. Of course his hesed was operative. Even that day I stood weeping at the gaping graveside of my son Marlon. Yahweh's hesed, by definition, can't be anything other than operative. It's in its nature to keep going continually, relentlessly, inexorably, everlastingly. That's what hesed means. We as believers this evening, we need to really take on board this idea, don't we? That the whole concept of God's love for us being temperamental and fluctuating and performance related and circumstance related, that whole concept is actually as ridiculous as the concept of dry rain or inaudible music or any other paradox, contradiction in terms you want to come up with. God's love for us is hesed. And it cannot therefore be anything other than operative. In our disobedient moments, as well as in our obedient moments, in our traumatic circumstances, as well as in our happy circumstances, it's the very nature of God's love that it cannot stop. It cannot fail. It cannot dry up. It cannot lose its momentum. It cannot peter out. We need to grasp the sheer unbreakableness, the sheer solidity, don't we, of God's love for us, his children. So that's our first heading this evening, an excited epiphany. But then secondly, a surprising strategy. A surprising strategy. And I'm referring, of course, to Naomi's strategy, which she shares with Ruth in the opening verses of chapter 3, in order to facilitate this exciting possibility that she's had her epiphany about. And this strategy then, it requires a bit of consideration, doesn't it, from us this evening, partly because it is so surprising, and also because Naomi, over the years, has received a fair bit of criticism for her strategy here. Criticism which, in my view at least, is really quite unjustified. I've encountered it in at least three forms. So, first form then. Naomi here is being like Sarah and taking matters into her own hands rather than letting God work out his purposes in his way according to his timetable. That's a criticism I've heard made of Naomi. And when I say then like Sarah, I'm referring of course to the Hagar episode there in the book of Genesis. You remember how Abraham and Sarah have been promised by God descendants, but no descendants were forthcoming. And so Sarah comes up with a strategy, and her strategy is, Abraham, you sleep with my servant Hagar, and she can have children for me on my behalf, and so we'll have the descendants that God has promised. And here then, surely, the objection goes, the criticism goes, surely Naomi is just doing the same thing, coming up with a reckless strategy instead of leaving God to sort things out in his own way according to his own timetable. And I suppose there's a certain plausibility about this because of the parallels between Sarah and Naomi that we've already identified in this series. the fact then that they are both these barren women. And it seems plausible then, as I say, that both of them are similarly being rash in the solution they're coming to for their barrenness. But the criticism overlooks the very significant differences between the two cases. There's a significant difference in the outcome, isn't there? So in Sarah's case then, her strategy was not to be the way that her barrenness was ended. The whole Hagar episode was just going to cause an almighty mess. That was all it was going to cause. A mess that actually we're still feeling the implications of to some degree in our world today. Whereas Naomi's strategy, it was the way that her barrenness was going to be ended. It was through Boaz and Ruth coming together. But then more significantly still, Naomi here didn't have a promise from God. Sarah did. And so yes, we can say of Sarah, she was seeking in her own reckless way to kind of hurry along a solid divine promise. She should have been patient. The promise was there, but that doesn't apply with Naomi. There's no promise here. Naomi is more in Esther's category. Esther there going into the king. And it was an initiative, in her case, of course, that Mordecai had come up with. And it was a bold and a brave and a risky initiative. There's no promise as to the outcome. And here for Ruth going to Boaz this night, there was no promise regarding the outcome. So there are all these differences then between Naomi's situation and Sarah's situation. And so it seems to me that that criticism is an unfair one. Then a second criticism. Naomi here is contravening the biblical principle of male initiative in courtship, that the male should take the initiative. There was an article about this in Evangelicals Now just last year. I quote from it, "God has given men the role of the pursuer in romantic relationships." There was actually the following month a much better article which dismantled the first one. And apart from the fact then that there are no texts that this can take its cue from, this idea, if we're going to run with it and we're going to condemn Naomi, we have to condemn a whole load of other biblical narratives also, don't we? You think, for instance, of Abigail in 1 Samuel 25. And Abigail is presented there very positively, isn't she? We're told in verse 3 that she was a discerning woman. She's presented very positively. And yet, I don't think you have to read between the lines to realize that Abigail there, as she addresses David, and you can read it later, she is being at least a little suggestive as she finishes her long speech by saying, "I know Nabal, my husband, is going to die soon. Once he's been dealt with, David, remember me." And you can almost see her fluttering her eyelashes somewhat as she says those words. There's certainly a forwardness, a pursuit going on there. Or more obviously, you think of Isaac and Rebecca. And this is the great romance of the Old Testament. It's described at such astonishing length, and neither of them is pursuing each other, are they? But Isaac certainly isn't a pursuer. He's waiting at home entirely passively for a servant to bring a wife back. And yet, as I say, it's portrayed in such glowing terms there in the Old Testament. And so it seems to me that we have very little biblical ground for criticizing Naomi on that score. But then a third criticism, and I guess this is perhaps the most troubling. Naomi is counseling here sexually seductive behavior. Naomi is counseling sexually seductive behavior. And that criticism then does seem very plausible. It seems very plausible because Many of the terms that she uses are terms which elsewhere in the Old Testament unambiguously have sexual connotations. The verb to lie, which she uses twice there in verse 4, you all know that that is a standard Old Testament word for sexual relationship. Or the word uncover there in verse 4 is often used in sexual contexts in the Old Testament of undressing, complete undressing. The word feet is often a euphemism in the Old Testament. And so undoubtedly there is this language used. And of course it's also given added plausibility, I guess, because this is the period of the judges after all. It's a period where you have people who otherwise might seem quite upstanding people suddenly making these completely mad moral judgments. You have a man like Jephthah, who is a servant of the Lord and does mighty things in the Lord's name, and yet he suddenly has this moment of utter madness where he vows, "I'm going to sacrifice whoever comes out of my house first to meet me when I come back." It's human sacrifice, I think, he's contemplating all along. And you think, how can he possibly be contemplating human sacrifice? A man of God, a judge in God's service. But that's what happened in those days. And so perhaps it's happening with Naomi here. And she, yes, on the whole, is this Yahweh-worshipping woman, but she just has this moment of madness and is telling Ruth to go and be seductive here on this night on the threshing floor. It seems to me that even if Naomi's moral compass had allowed her to advise that, and I doubt that it could possibly have done, but even if it had, surely she knew enough about Boaz to know that she was choosing the wrong approach for that man. Surely she knew that, as we said last time, in dark Bethlehem, with its dark moral climate, there was a moral microclimate, at least in Boaz's field, where righteousness prevailed. Surely she knew that the way to this man's heart, even if no other man's heart in Bethlehem, the way to this man's heart was not through sexually seductive behavior. And I take it then that the language she uses in verse 4, it is to be taken at face value. And when she says, "Go and uncover his feet, go and lie down there," that's all she means. Now, I think that there may be another level here where those sexual connotations are not entirely insignificant, and I'll come to that in a moment. But for Naomi's part, I think she's intending this purely at face value. And that then raises the question, doesn't it? Well, what then is going on here? What's going on here? Well, I think we need to notice first verse 23, the last verse of the previous chapter. And we can easily read verse 23 there as a rosy conclusion to a happy chapter. Here's Ruth, and right up until the end of the harvest, she stays there in Boaz's field. Isn't that lovely? I think in actual fact, verse 23 there is a verse heavy with disappointment. See, there on day one of Ruth's gleaning in Boaz's field, there on day one, I've argued tonight, Naomi has had this epiphany and has dreamt this dream of Boaz and Ruth getting married. And Ruth then is now going to stay for the rest of the harvest. That's going to be several weeks, a couple of months perhaps. Ruth is going to stay every day in Boaz's field. That means they're going to bump into each other on a daily basis, probably. All that opportunity, Naomi's thinking, for romance to develop. And then we come to verse 23. And the harvest ended. And then we have that last line. And I think that's sequential here. So the last line comes after the end of the harvest. We're told that the harvest ended, and at that point, does Ruth now go to live in the house of her new husband, Boaz, which is what Naomi had prayed back in chapter 1, verse 9? No. Ruth is still living with her mother-in-law. The harvest has ended. All those days of the two of them bumping into each other every day come to an end. No romance, no engagement, no marriage. Ruth still living with Naomi. It could easily actually have triggered in Naomi a relapse, couldn't it, into her former bitterness. It's another blow, isn't it? There have been all those blows in her experience, all these deaths. And then suddenly things had looked up. Suddenly it seemed as though the kinsman redeemer had emerged on the scene. Everything was going to be all right after all. But now the harvest's over and nothing's happened. And Ruth could have gone right back down again to the bottom, back into the depths of bitterness. And she doesn't. And that's why, rather than see her scheme, her strategy in chapter 3 as a discreditable thing, we should see it as a great act of faith, actually. This is Naomi now, still believing in the kindness of Yahweh that hasn't been forsaken. And rather than sinking into bitterness again, she's assuming that Yahweh is kindly disposed toward them. So we need to notice verse 23. And it seems to me then that Naomi realizes at this point that Boaz's inaction, despite having shown such initial interest in Ruth, having lavished all that generosity on her on day one, Naomi realizes that Boaz's subsequent inaction during the rest of the harvest had two explanations. Explanation number one, quite simply, it was probably very awkward for him. He was a landowner. It was not normal for a landowner to have much interaction, to pay much attention to lowly gleaners, especially Moabite ones, a foreign woman. She was at the very bottom of the pile. He was at the top of the pile. It would not have been easy for him to have paid her much attention, for him to have had much interaction with her in that public context of the harvest fields. And that, I think, is why then Naomi is telling Ruth to go at night and see Boaz. It's not because the night has some sexual connotations. It's because it's the same reason as Nicodemus goes to see Jesus at night many centuries later. It's because it's a secret context. There's privacy at night. They can have a conversation, whereas they couldn't have a conversation in the harvest fields. And then the other explanation she realizes, I think, for Boaz's inaction is this: that Ruth is still in her period of mourning for her husband Mahlon. Ruth is still in her period of mourning for her husband Mahlon. And it would be inappropriate, therefore, and insensitive for Boaz to make any advances when Ruth is still mourning her former husband. That's the significance, it seems to me, of verse 3. You know, you get all these commentators and preachers talking about Ruth there kind of dressing up to the nines in verse 3. I don't think there's anything of that going on. The closest parallel to this language that we have in the Old Testament is 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 20, where David has lost his child. And you remember how for a week David has been in absolute mourning. And we read then in 2 Samuel 12, verse 20, David arose from the earth where he'd been lying and washed and anointed himself and changed his clothes. Those three things. To come out of his official period of mourning, what did he do? He washed, he anointed himself, he changed his clothes. What's Naomi telling Ruth to do? To wash, anoint herself, change her clothes. And in fact, the ESV is right to translate that word cloak as cloak. Plain old cloak. Again, people tell us that here she was kind of tarting herself up and dressing up to impress Boaz. We're told in Exodus 22:27 that this cloak was what a tramp would cover himself with to keep himself warm in the night. There was nothing particularly alluring about this garment. The point is not that she's dressing herself up to attract Boaz. She's She's not here going to set his pulse racing by the way she's dressing, but she is going to indicate she's no longer mourning her late husband and that she is now available for marriage. That's the point. She's indicating her availability. And so Naomi's surprising strategy then, far from being the dubious thing that it's often presented as, it seems to me that in those terms it is perfectly satisfactory and explicable. But just before we close, I did mention a couple of minutes ago sexual connotations, although it seems to me not there in Naomi's intention, there is a level at which they are perhaps significant. You see, let's remember that Ruth is a Moabite woman. And the narrator doesn't let us forget that, does he or she? Because even verse 21 of chapter 2, where it just seems utterly redundant, utterly gratuitous, we're told, Ruth the Moabite said, ... He won't let us forget that Ruth is a Moabite woman. Now, I think it's fair to say that Moabite women in the Old Testament are not known for their sexual propriety. So you think of the mother of this whole nation. The mother of the Moabite nation is a woman who in Genesis 19 gets her father drunk and then sleeps with him. Or you think of Numbers 25, where the Israelites are camped in the desert and the Moabite women seduce the Israelites' men. And that's the kind of associations then that Moabite women have in the Old Testament. And that then is Ruth's background. And I think then the language that Naomi uses in verse 4 here, it's meant to raise in the reader's mind these sexual possibilities. It's meant to raise a certain suspicion and cynicism, I think, in the reader's mind. The reader who is schooled in the Old Testament is automatically going to think, oh dear, this is going to end in disaster. A Moabite woman going to an Israelite man in the middle of the night. Well, she may have acted all sweetly up until now, looking after her mother-in-law and all the rest of it, but her true colours will be revealed now. You can take the woman out of Moab, but you can't take Moab out of the woman. Can the leopard really change his spots? You can bet your life that it won't just be the bedclothes that she lifts and that's it that night, and there'll be nothing more goes on. It's that kind of thing that the narrator is trying to get his readers to think. And that's why it's so wonderful then that our section closes with Ruth simply saying, all that you say I will do. And the next section will reveal that she did keep Naomi's instructions. And she didn't go further. And she didn't act like a Moabite woman on that threshing floor that night. But she acted as a godly Israelite woman. She doesn't behave that night as everything in her background is pushing her to behave that night. She acts differently. Why? Because as we saw in chapter 1, this woman has experienced regeneration, the new birth. And in that context, the leopard can change his spots. And the one who was locked into a background of sin and iniquity can become entirely different. And that's what we see with Ruth here. A Moabite of all women acting with such decency and propriety at midnight with this man on the threshing floor. It's amazing. That's what we're supposed to see here. And that's the grace of God. The grace of God means that we can change. The grace of God means that we can rise above our backgrounds, our gene pools, our former lifestyles, the lifestyles of our ancestors going back years, as in Ruth's case here. The grace of God can blast through all of that and can make us new people, transform people, holy people, whatever we were by nature, whatever our background was by nature. Perhaps tonight you're thinking, well, my tendencies toward this sin or that failing are so marked I can't change. And this passage is saying to us, as the Bible consistently says to us, by the grace of God, if you're trusting in Christ, if you're indwelt by the Spirit, by the grace of God, you can change. What a wonderful message. Amen. Well, our final hymn then is 5.